it's happened. We're just going to do it on one scanner. For me, 1.5 T any day of the week.
At the end of the day, if something is wrong on that report, are you answer for it? Or is it the manufacturer of the AI system?
Some of the stuff you could still get from Echo, but it's the tissue characterization on MRI that's completely revolutionized what we do.
Basically, it showed up that there has been like a fivefold increase in terms of cardiac MRI scans performed in 10 years.
I would say that the biggest learning curve for radiographers with this is the ECG. And in the end, stress perfusion is better at 3T. No question about that.
Do you think that COVID-19 might have an impact in increasing even more this numbers of this need for cardiac MRI scans?
And his heart, rather than being pointing up over here, was actually on the right side of the chest.
There's an unclear correlation between COVID-19 and myocarditis, and that comes about from, I believe, a controversial paper that was released. I know a few scanners already can detect if the patient is in distress or not. So I think we're going quite fast in that direction.
Sedo, here we go. We got the second episode of the Cardiac MRI podcast. I would say this is more like a dedicated session that we're doing at Everything MRI. And we had a first session, a lovely session with Filippo, Deputy Superintendent, Cardiac MRI Superintendent at Guy's at St. Thomas Hospital. And now we have you, and it's a great pleasure because I'm pretty sure you will be able to give us some valuable insights about MRI. And help us to unveiling a little bit more of the secrets of what we don't know, which is quite a lot about cardiac MRI. But you're a consultant cardiologist at King's College Hospital. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about you, why you're here with us?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I think, firstly, it's always a pleasure to come and talk about what I love in life at work. So cardiac MRI is very much my passion. So I went into cardiology actually because I loved imaging. So I started actually because echocardiography really, absolutely as a junior doctor, was something that I thought was really impressive. Started to do it as a junior, and that led me to want to have a career in cardiology. Once I then sort of thought about it, imaging was clearly the path for me. And I, in 2010, went off to work with James Moon, who you may or may not have come across as a professor now at Barts. We were working at a place called the Heart Hospital, which no longer exists. Unfortunately, it was a lovely hospital. It's actually, they turned it into a urology hospital in central London, but it was a dedicated heart hospital, had its own MRI scanner. And that was my PhD level work. So it's actually an MD, which is a sort of, a medical PhD in T1 and T2 mapping, which I suspect we'll come on to talk about a bit later on. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Finished my training and wanted to set up and run an MRI service, which I was very lucky to be able to then do at King's College Hospital, which is in South London. So I had a sort of a bit of a service that was being led from St. Thomas's as an outsourced service, but they wanted an in-house service. And that in 2015 was where it all started for me. So I've set up a service there, which I think when we started was scanning, I think we were doing about 2 or 3 a week, and we now do 50.
Wow.
So it's a massive change. And we've seen that change in the UK in many, many hospitals. The change in what we do in cardiac MRI has been enormous in the last 15 years. And I love it. I love the academic side of it, the educational side of it, doing stuff at national level, trying to help people who want to come into the field, the interaction with radiographers. And I think that's where this
interaction
that we had working at Lister. A hospital. That's sort of my background with it. I love it. And it ties in well with my clinical cardiology interest, which is heart failure. A lot of our patients' heart failure will need cardiac MRI scanning. So it's a nice combination for me. That's the majority of my working week, heart failure.
Yeah, I think we have a lot to talk about already.
Yeah, it's good to say that.
I would like to ask you one thing about your journey that you were talking about. What was the main thing on MRI that changed cardiology for you? Because you said you started then with MRI. What was the main thing that if you could point out one thing that changed the way you work?
Changed the way I work. So, if you look back at where we were before I started doing cardiac MR, so in the sort of 2005 to 2010, there was MRI going on, but it was kind of a little bit fledgling at that stage. It was quite difficult to get scans. There were very few centers that did it. And some of the stuff you could still get from echo, but it's the tissue characterization on MRI that's completely revolutionized what we do for many reasons, but predominantly in the earlier stages was about making a diagnosis. So finding things that you just didn't know were there before. And so when you start your new service, what you find is everybody thinks, oh, this probably won't change much because we've got echo. And then, of course, very quickly, all your colleagues buy in because they start seeing actually echo's fine for the majority of things in cardiology. But there's a load of niche stuff where we were missing stuff before that we now can see what it actually was. And of course, that then completely changed what you might do.
Is that why you actually also went into research as well, probably?
So why did I go into research? So the first thing to say about that is in this country, most cardiology registrars do research. About 70% of us do it. So that journey is almost preordained for you.
Okay.
I wanted to do it. I'd actually been involved with research before. So before I started doing MRI, I'd done some research in resuscitation. So I'm actually quite a...
Around 80 papers, maybe?
Yeah,
on cardiac MRI. I don't know if
it's moved. So before that, I did quite a lot of stuff in the resuscitation field about using defibrillators. Yeah. And so I've always been interested in research. And it's very different to clinical, because clinical is thinking about the patient in front of you. Research is thinking about, actually, in 10 years' time, what should we do to this patient? What are we going to be able to do? What new sequences are we going to have? What new cool technology are we going to have? And can you be at the forefront of trying to,
predict the future,
kind of? Yeah, absolutely.
Can I ask you something, Dan? Because I already have a curiosity from your introduction. Yeah. You said something now that I have stuck here in my mind. I want to ask you something. So you said that you started building out, let's say, the service, and you had a couple of patients, 2-3.
Yeah.
Now you're getting like something like 40-50.
Yes.
So about this, in literature, there is a study, I think, conducted by the British Society of CMR.
Yeah.
I think it was from 2008 and 2018, which showed off that there has been like a fivefold increase in terms of cardiac MRI scans performed in 10 years.
Yeah.
Do you think for this trend, there is a specific reason, in your opinion? Something that can justify or just this increasing need for cardiac MRI scans?
Many reasons. So the first thing is, so why is it that in effect putting me at King suddenly created all this extra work? Because the patients didn't change. You're not suddenly got a load of people in 2016 at King's that didn't exist in 2013 sort of thing. So the first thing is you need drivers to do it. You need individuals who are going to try and explain to others. So senior colleagues of mine, when they trained, MRI didn't exist as a thing for cardiac. Yep. So they didn't know what we do. What's the point of this? And that sort of information might come their way through conferences. But when you stick somebody on site that they're directly interacting with, that makes an enormous difference.
It's kind of a peer pressure there.
Yeah, partly. But I think, I suppose if you want to put it another way, one of the challenges I see in cardiac CT is where some services have failed is if you have a radiologist who doesn't come to your cardiology MDT meetings, there become problems, because if you can't put a face to a name on a report and you haven't got somebody saying, actually, this is what's good with CT, this is the cool things we can do, this is where we want referrals, you start running into problems with this. And I mean, it's no different to, those radiologists when they're reporting a CT chest for lung cancer will go to the lung cancer MDT to show the oncologist, here's the cancer. This is where it is, or the surgeon, here's where it is. This is what it looks like. Here's what's around it. It's the same sort of concept. So you've got to be interactive with colleagues. The technique, of course, research has massively increased in the field. It's well funded for research in this country. So the British Heart Foundation, who's a big charity funder of what we do, are partly responsible for that. They've put a lot of investment in. So you've just got a lot of people who are interested, and they've driven this, and then the data then comes with it. And then, of course, you start finding things that people didn't see before. And of course, there then becomes, what else am I missing? So of course, it becomes just a snowball of increase in referrals. So.
And I might have also like a follow-up question about that. Yeah. Thank you for the explanation. It was great. And I completely agree with all the reasons. But I think there is an interesting thing about the future as well. Yeah. I noticed like on my notes over there, they are also like a cardiology co-lead for COVID-19 services in London, right?
Yes.
Do you think, still referring to this kind of survey about the fact that there is a massive increase in cardiac, for all the reasons that you said for cardiac MRI examination, do you think that COVID-19 might have an impact in increasing even more this numbers of this need for cardiac MRI scans?
So you've got to look at what can cardiac MR do that other things struggle with. And so with the COVID side of things, particularly early on, there was the debate around myocarditis, so inflammation of heart muscle. You can't see that on echo. So ultrasound is not good for this. If you have wall motion abnormality, so if there's enough inflammation that the heart doesn't contract very well, you'll see that on echo. Beyond that, if the heart contraction is normal, it will just look like a normal echo scan. So MRI comes into its own for imaging inflammation. And so, of course, for myocarditis, which, of course, can be associated with COVID and a whole number of other things. But, of course, it got a huge amount of airtime through the COVID pandemic because so many people got COVID. I suspect everybody in this room has had COVID, right?
Probably even now.
So, it was suddenly you chucked in this new disease. And I think some of it also, one of the things we talked about a lot in our department was one of the things that COVID did to academics, because we were interested because new disease, and we actually knew what it was going to do in 2020. So things that were less of interest to us as clinicians suddenly became more. So I give the example that we do a blood test called troponin, which is a marker for heart muscle damage. On intensive care units, often might be slightly elevated for a whole number of reasons when someone's very sick. And we wouldn't be that interested in that. It's just a marker that you're very sick in effect. But suddenly, of course, if the patient's got COVID, that might be interesting. Why have they got this? And so suddenly you've put this patient through an MRI scan, whereas the patient in the room next to them who had some other illness that might have done the same thing had never been that interesting before. So I think it changed mindsets a little bit.
Yeah.
But because MRI is so good at imaging inflammation in the heart muscle, that's why, I definitely added a bit to it without question. I mean, it added to our workload without question it did.
Talking about the COVID situation, I was watching one of your lectures that you gave a while ago. I think it was 2020, 2021, something like that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned actually about this myocarditis and COVID that you believe, and let me just quote clearly, there's an unclear correlation between COVID-19 and myocarditis. And that comes about from, I believe, a controversial paper that was released. Can you just go through that statement?
So the challenge with this becomes, if you go back maybe 5-10 years, or pre-COVID, go back sort of 5 years, the majority of people we were diagnosing with myocarditis were people who came into hospital, usually with chest pain mimicking a heart attack, because heart muscle inflammation is what you get in a heart attack. So they often present in a similar way, have very high troponin levels, and then go through an MRI scan and you find some quite impressive changes. That's what myocarditis for the majority of patients in effect used to be. The problem we had with COVID was you had plenty of that. I mean, that happened. But there was then this group of patients who, in effect, particularly in the more sort of long COVID cohort, or patients who'd had COVID and were quite well and hadn't had symptoms, that suddenly people started looking at, in effect, a group of patients that we wouldn't normally study. And the question then is how subtle. Looking at subtlety is more difficult. Looking at gross change is very easy. But as with all imaging techniques, the more subtle the problem, the more difficult it then becomes. And then you start getting the debate around one person might think this is abnormal, another person might not. There are issues with mapping techniques in younger females, particularly because the myocardium is thinner, which means the spatial resolution becomes more difficult. It becomes easier to overcall, in my view. But the reality becomes that might be wrong. The gold standard for diagnosis of myocarditis is a biopsy. So, at the end of the day, if you really want to know, you've got to do a biopsy with this. In this country, we almost never biopsy for it, probably because you're both sitting there thinking, biopsy of the heart doesn't sound.
It sounds very vague.
So
I actually wanted to test my heart.
If I said to you, have an MRI scan of your heart tomorrow, you'd be thinking, as long as you're not claustrophobic, you'd be thinking, well, whatever, I don't care. I'll sleep well tonight, not worried about it. If I said you're going to biopsy your heart tomorrow, you'd be thinking, actually, the risk is small. But we share that view. So it's rare to actually do the gold standard with this. So of course, you're then left with, well, is MRI sort of the gold standard?
And it's a grey area then.
So in effect, I believe the reason why you saw a lot of conflicting data around this is where it's more subtle, it becomes more difficult, becomes more of a grey zone. What is very likely, and certainly my experience of this now, seeing in effect what's happened to a lot of these patients down the line, is these more subtle cases are very unlikely to be problematic. Because, of course, at the time, you think, well, actually, is this going to be a problem for this patient in a year's time? Are they going to run into problems like heart failure or whatever? That isn't what I've seen with this through my services. Those that have had things that are very borderline generally have been fine.
Yep.
So in effect, there becomes, it almost becomes, well, if you found it, does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
The problem can become, if you label, what do you then do with treatment? You know, do you start giving aggressive treatment that might switch off the immune system? That's not without yep. risk. So, you know, for some patients, it's difficult with this. And we try and, the ones that are subtle, we try and discuss as a group because, you know, I think sometimes that's what, in effect, for me, absolutely. Is what MDT is for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, see what other people think about this. And you will often hear debate amongst all of us around, you know, but whereas the old style patient, if you like, or you know, the patient who came in with, you know, bad chest pain, large troponin rise, you wouldn't normally need to put that through an MDT. It's usually blindingly obvious on MRI what the problem is.
Absolutely.
The more subtle one where the troponin's normal or very marginal.
That's where the question arises.
Much more difficult case.
I asked you this because it's quite often to see athletes nowadays having more cardiac arrests or more cardiac problems. And even today, a 15-year-old player in Spain just died of a heart attack, sudden heart attack while they were practicing.
Yeah.
So that's why I asked you, because a lot of people mentioned this is a COVID problem, long COVID or the vaccines or something like that. And I wanted to know if there's a way to demystify this or if you actually believe it's something like that or if you have another opinion.
Sudden cardiac arrest in athletes is not a new thing, unfortunately, is not a new thing. And different countries have different views about what they do with this. So the most common cause of that happening in somebody who is very young is a condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a genetic problem. Now, if you're at home in Italy, you're not allowed to do competitive sport without screening for that problem.
Yeah, we're so always ECG, very conservative.
Right, ECG.
Like with pizza and pasta. We have ECG. But let's not talk about this.
You're going to digress. But what I would say, if I lived in Italy, I would probably be about 20 stone heavier.
I think all the food is.
I think we need to clarify what 20 stone is.
Rome is like my favorite city. But goodness, but Italian food, best food. So the most common cause is a condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, genetic problem where the heart muscle is too thick. About one in 500 people have it, which is why the view in Italy is to screen for it. There's a load of debate. That's a whole nother session about whether screening is the right thing to do for this problem. Most people will not run an aggressive course with that, even if they've got it. That's not the most common outcome, to have a cardiac arrest as a result of it. But the screening is done for that. But there are lots of other reasons why it can happen. Other inherited heart problems, problems with the electrics in the heart. Myocarditis, yes, is associated with sudden death. Problems with coronary artery disease. In young people, that's uncommon to have. So whether this was to say to you, be careful with cardiac arrest and heart attack are not interchangeable. Yep. Heart attack, block coronary vessel. Yep. Cardiac arrest, heart stops. Many reasons why cardiac arrest might happen. Heart attack, blocked vessel. And that can happen in young people.
This is really important, yeah.
So we saw, for example, with COVID made it a bit more likely to have for younger, more so females, have something called coronary dissection. So as you might think, an aortic dissection, the coronary is a little bit more likely to dissect. The AstraZeneca vaccine in a small number of people made blood clots more common,
that was
as you might remember.
Quite around the news,
absolutely. I mean, I had one patient who unfortunately had a heart attack very shortly, a young patient had a heart attack very shortly after AstraZeneca vaccine, almost certainly was related, was very unlucky. So, you know, all of these things, my own personal view with this is I don't think those things are why you're seeing what you're seeing. I just think you're seeing more press around things that were happening anyway. People are showing more interest.
We have more
in
access to information,
completely.
Maybe.
I mean, you know, I remember going actually to a Tottenham, we talked about Chelsea earlier, I remember going to a Tottenham-Chelsea game. It would have been probably 10 years ago. And not long before that game, a Serie B player in Italy had had a cardiac arrest.
There you go.
And the reason why I remember it is because one of the tragedies of it is that nobody did chest compressions on him. So I spent a lot of time trying to teach CPR. And there's been a lot learned, I think, in Italy about that case.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know,
I think it's changing
CPR
now. Yeah,
I think it's the only good thing about that incident. It's
there were people awareness.
Without the incidents, nothing will change, to be honest.
I agree.
So, unfortunately.
So you know, these things still happened before, yeah. unfortunately. I mean, we have a very prominent charity in this country called Cardiac Risk in the Young, who offers screening to young people who want to have it. Oh. If you become a professional athlete, quite often you'll get screened in this country.
For example, so, in Portugal, I used to play basketball.
Yeah.
And the screening we had was literally an ECG.
Yeah.
And maybe a treadmill for half an hour where they would do the tracing, yeah. and that was it. Nothing else.
The biggest yield, so if you look at what CRY do, Cardiac Risk in the Young, the majority of the screenings they do will just be an ECG. And then if the ECG is normal and there's nothing else exciting, I mean, obviously if the patient comes in and says, oh, I've got family history of sudden death in somebody who you'd do more with that, even whatever on the ECG. The majority of patients, so if there's nothing in the family history, they're otherwise well and the ECG is normal, that's all you do. Some people screen with ECG and ultrasound and echo.
But that's UK or you mean...
It depends. So in the UK, for example, you know, if you were going to sign for Chelsea Football Club tomorrow, I would be stunned if you got your name on the bottom of the contract without an echo.
Yeah. Because, for example, in Portugal, for me, I was doing that and I have a heart murmur.
Yeah.
Since I was. Then I have history of cardiac failure and all of those situations. And they never did any MRI. They never did any kind of other tests for me to play. And I was playing, I was practicing every day twice and then playing on the weekends. And I had panic attacks. I thought it was cardiac arrest or I was having something like that.
I mean, most people have got a murmur. If they go for screening, you'd end up doing an echo. The majority of murmurs are benign.
Yeah, mine was diagnosed as benign.
In the end, the vast majority are benign, but most people end up with an echo. Once you've gone down the screening route, if you find something, most people end up with an echo.
Okay.
MRI, not normally used in screening for this sort of thing.
That's what I was aiming at.
So I was going to say, so that MRI generally comes in when there's debate around an abnormal ECG. Yeah. Or an abnormal echo.
So when there's suspicion of pathology already, that's when we go to the MRI.
Talking about cardiac MRI, though, specifically, because I think we have a good portion of our audience which are radiographers, cardiac MRI radiographers, cardiologists, a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. So going a little bit more in detail of the scan itself, I think people over there, they would like to know from a national award-winning consultant, don't lie about this, I know, I didn't want to say, but I have to say, what might be your suggestion about, let's start from a very basic, what would be like a good way for patient preparation for a cardiac MRI scan? Do you have any tips and tricks about patient preparation, anything you would recommend to our radiographer or even like to the fellow, to whoever does a screening, whatever?
So the first thing, as always with this, is before the patient even gets to you, there's sometimes stuff you need to do with this. So broadly speaking in cardiac MR, there's, I suppose you could almost sort of say, three types of scan. There's a sort of a basic where the majority of patients will have some cine imaging done. So we'll have a look at the heart moving and give them some contrast, give them some gadolinium. We have some patients that are congenital patients. That's a whole, again, it's a whole nother topic.
A whole topic, yeah.
And then the other group is stress MRI. Yeah. And now that group of patients, if you don't do the bit before they get to you right, the whole thing falls in a heap. So they're going to get a drug called adenosine. Adenosine is a drug which is a vasodilator. So in effect, the way the drug works is it makes the coronary arteries get bigger if they're normal. You then put contrast in and see whether it all goes in effect at the same speed down the coronary arteries. If there's a blockage, that blockage will mean the contrast will go slower down that vessel. If you have caffeine in the lead up to the test, caffeine stops adenosine from working. So it's a complete disaster. Now, I can tell you at King's, there is no route to get to MRI that doesn't take you past a Costa coffee, right?
Just where you need it.
Costa coffee, of course.
They're not stupid at Costa. They've positioned themselves beautifully so that every entrance to the hospital, you've got to walk past one, right? Which is great for them and actually great for me when I go to work in the morning. But actually, if you want to do a stress MRI, it's a complete freaking disaster.
Okay, but here comes the question.
You know,
would you accept like a patient that probably have like a coffee or something like that? Because I know it can be quite unbalanced,
decision. Yeah. So, I mean, this is difficult. It depends when they had it. So some of the challenge with this is some people... So even if they've done what you've told them, some people are actually slow metabolizers of caffeine, which actually makes the stress difficult. So one of the big things for us actually when we do the study is looking at, have we adequately stressed the heart or not? Because sometimes if you haven't adequately stressed the heart and it looks normal, that's not useful information. In effect, that becomes potentially a false negative test. So from my point of view, the key thing is the whatever you send to the patient, however you communicate with them, you need to tell them. Now, the biggest problem we've got the NHS at the moment is waiting times. So what inevitably is happening is the patient gets the letter today saying, come to King's for your stress MRI scan. And we've written in big bold on the letter, don't have caffeine. Now, of course, if there's now a 6-month delay, or a 6 months time, you think the patient's going to remember
that? The only thing they will remember is the date.
Absolutely. Right, because they put it in their phone, you know, sort of thing. So it becomes key that somebody is on the case in your admin team to say to the patient. Now, of course, in the private sector where the scan, you know, you might be booking the scan a week later, you're probably going to be fine. Even then, we still have problems.
Yeah, even then, we call the patients the day before at least 2 days before just to confirm. Even, for example, a small bowel, we also confirm they're coming 1 hour before.
Because the problem you've then got is if the patient turns up having just had a coffee, what do you then do? Which is coming on to the question you asked. It is difficult. I don't generally scan people within 6 hours of having had a coffee unless there's an extremely good reason
for it.
You can sometimes get around to give higher doses. It depends on a whole number of things. There are some patients where you're a bit worried about giving a higher dose. It's looking for me, some of it is also how important is the stress bit of the study? Is it so some studies we do massive yield, some studies the referrer sort of saying, whilst you're in the scanner, could you do stress?
Yeah.
Rather than thinking it's probably going to show something bad, that sort of patient you probably wouldn't recall necessarily. You might give it a go. And if they really had no stress response, you'll have to then write to the referrer saying that they didn't have a stress. Do you want me to recall them? It's difficult because sending a patient away is difficult.
An evaluation case by case almost.
But for me, it is. It has to be because it is difficult. I mean, I almost never do it within, if somebody's had coffee within 6 hours. You know, it's very rare that I would have done it.
So on top of that, is this something, I know you love to teach.
We
work together and it was nice that you actually sit with us and you teach us. And you are one of those cardiologists that actually scan as well.
Yeah, very much so.
So you like to scan.
Yeah.
So do you have any tips and tricks for people, radiographers that are learning how to do cardiac? Because it's something that a lot of our audience likes to learn. I want to do cardiac. How do I do it? Is there anything that you would suggest to them for them to learn quicker?
I would say that the biggest learning curve for radiographers with this is the ECG. The biggest problems come with the ECG because it's not part of radiography training. Well, many things. Because it leads on to, in effect, the original question, which
he's
is...
He's very optimistic.
How do you...
Now he has this new beard that makes him even more optimistic.
I like the beard. Very much.
Thank you very much.
I would have, takes but my wife has said no to the beard. So having got the patient in, the next key bit of this is getting a good ECG trace. So if you get a bad trace at the beginning, you are... an English terminology is peeing into the wind with what will then happen. So your preparation of the patient at the beginning is actually crucial to this. And not infrequently, if the ECG is not great, I sometimes see radiographers say, I can't be bothered to, you know, I can see a trace. It's probably, and then of course they'll be calling you in about 10 minutes saying that the images look crap. So trying to get good trace is important. So you've got to think about good preparation of the chest, thinking about, you know, some because the one of the challenges, the lie of the heart and the chest is a bit different for everyone. I've got a beautiful case from back when I started at King's. We could not get an ECG trace on this patient. We ended up using a pulse oximeter.
Okay. Not as reliable, but
once we not ideal, but we just literally could not.
You can get something, what you might desire.
I mean, this case is extraordinary. I mean, I've often shown it at conferences. Basically, the reason we couldn't get a trace is the patient, unfortunately for him, and we didn't know this until we started. So when we did the axial imaging, he'd had a pneumonectomy as a child. And his heart, rather than being pointing up over here, was actually on the right side of the chest, actually the up against the back wall of the right side of the chest.
I've got this image
just like, okay, now I see why putting ECG stickers over here was getting a trace. But I mean, that's obviously an unusual case. But I mean, getting a good trace is absolutely pivotal with this. I can always tell when I work with a new radiographer, I can always tell whether they've done much cardiac MR, because for most scanners, they're not just doing cardiac MR. So usually you're starting a list and the scan they did the night before was a knee or whatever it might have been. So the ECG on the scanner isn't on. So they've put the ECG on the patient, yep. but there's no actual ECG trace. You could tell the radiographers who've done a bit of this because they'll want to see the trace because they want to see how good it is. Those who don't know what they're doing won't turn the trace on. So it's your straight away your first message when you're looking. Absolutely, you see you're probably quite new to this.
It's just because, trusting the machine blind because they don't know more than that.
Because what you then need to look at is the heart rhythm normal? Because all these things are going to determine what then happens in the study. What's the heart rhythm? And you don't need to get it exactly right, but broadly speaking, have I got a good trace? Is it regular? And is the sort of computer software picking up each QRS complex? Sometimes it will miss out QRS complexes. All these things are going to determine what then happens in the study.
It will drive the choice of protocol as well.
To some extent, yeah, because you may change based on that. But the predominant issue from the radiographer's perspective is if you've got a rubbish trace or if the patient's got an arrhythmia, it's going to make your life more difficult. And if you just try and do the things that work for your average normal heart, you'll get a set of images that are not very good.
It's not going to work.
And so, of course, then you need to learn, well, what do you do about it? And these are all that as you get more advanced, you learn all these things about what to do. So.
I actually want to underline the importance of what you said, because I think some people might say, well, actually, I believe it's more important if I learn how to plan this, how to plan that, which is important.
Important too. Yeah.
Trust me, I saw it, especially when you do like cardiac back-to-back, cardiac MRI. Let's say you have 10 on a day. Then, you know, even if I have a patient that is a little bit more airy, you see the chest, you have a lot of airs, you say, well, I can still crack on. I might put one here, one here. Why do I need to shave it, my God? Losing maybe going with a little bit of delay, going home a little bit later on time. But ECG is crucial. It is at the very basic of the cardiac MRI scan. So those kind of like tips for patient preparation are essential. You cannot have a nice MRI scan. You can have it, but you need to be lucky at some point.
And I think I could probably put a shout out here to those men like me who've got hairy chests. The other thing is if you put a sticky on hairy chest and then pull it off at the end of the study, the patient won't love you for that either.
They're not coming back.
Getting a shave rather than a wax.
It happened to me today. The patient was screaming,
So, you know, for me, preparation of the chest, there's a bit of, most people use a bit of gel. There's gel stuff.
Clean
so basically,
prep,
clean prep. There's a whole load of different ones. So basically shave any chest hair, clean prep on, and make sure the trace is good. The scanners, a lot of the scanners with the newer scanners help you with this. They try and give you an idea of how good the trace is when you're actually inside the room with the patient. Yep. But if it's not good, as I say, just have in mind that you're going to, if you just think, oh, it looks all right, I know I'm only getting one bar out of five on the Siemens scanner, it'll probably be fine. It probably won't be, and particularly for a stress study, because the real problem is what you really don't want is the ECG to fail whilst you're giving the patient adenosine. Because the patient will not love you if you've got to repeat the adenosine, you know. So it's the one thing I would say to everyone, it's the most difficult bit. You know, the planning stuff is new, but it's something that radiographers are used to doing. They know how to use the scanner. And so, of course, in effect, it's just learning the sorts of views that we like to see. The bit that's completely left field for radiographers is the ECG. It's the hardest bit. And that's why I'd offer a lot of teaching to radiographers around ECGs, because it's the bit that is the most challenging bit.
Awesome. So we have no coffee.
Yeah.
ECG.
For stress study.
Yeah.
For stress study. If you have not having a stress study, then you can have as much coffee as you want.
Of course, good ECG and then good patient preparation and communication, I think, is essential there.
Yeah.
Can I say something about this, Sam? Because actually about stress study, we spoke with Filippo in our previous episode about benefits of doing stress perfusion scans at 3T. Now here's the question for every cardiologist I know. Someone says, because I'm a huge advocate for that. So what about you? Do you think, firstly, is there like a magnetic field strength that you would strongly recommend? Let's say that I think Sam asked this question to Filippo, if I recall. If I need to buy a scanner tomorrow, and I need to do
cardio. If you have your own clinic.
Exactly.
So if I was going to buy one scanner tomorrow to start a new service, without question, it would be 1.5T. Without question, it would be 1.5T. Awesome. I think it's a lot cheaper, but you might know better than me with that. So your bosses will like you for that too. But it's easier, and the benefits of 3T that you were starting to talk about with stress aren't enough to get over some of the challenges that you face, particularly with Artifact, particularly if you're a new center. So if you look at a lot of the centers that are doing 3T, the majority, like Amadeo Filippo Center, they've got a whole number of magnets, of which some of them are 3T and some are 1.5T. So if you just have, we're just going to do it on one scanner. For me, 1.5T any day of the week. It's much easier to scan on it. And in the end, stress perfusion is better at 3T. I mean, there's no question about that. If you were sort of saying to me, all you're going to do is stress perfusion, you know, with a whole number of people who do loads of this, yeah, you'd buy a 3T scanner. But the reality is, I mean, if you look at our service, I think it's about 20% stress and 80% non-stress. So, you know, their service does more stress than we do, but I mean, I don't know what their numbers are, but I would be stunned if it's more than 50-50, for example. Yeah. So you're still going to do a lot of non-stress. Artifact is, you know, much, 3T is much better now. The sequence is much, much Absolutely. Better now, but it's still not as easy as using a 1.5T scanner. So
One of the questions that I asked Filippo as well was about free breathing.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your thoughts on free breathing for patients? I know it's more comfortable for them, of course, and with the AI coming into play and new scanners having...
Yeah, without question, this is the future. I mean, I will be stunned in 10 years' time if we're doing much with breath hold, because the technology is getting better and better with this to allow you not to do it. I mean, where we're at now with it, there's a late enhancement sequence. And you think, I mean, for us, the late enhancement is often the crux of a lot of the studies that we're doing. On Siemens solar scanners, for example, I think you just get it. You don't even think you have to, in effect, buy it separately. I think it just comes as part of the package. You have a free breathe sequence that's pretty high resolution. Many people just default to using it. Cine is more difficult, but actually, you know, compressed sense on Siemens is pretty good. So, you know, your patient who can't breath hold is not really a problem anymore. I mean, that's still not ideal, but you will get a diagnostic scan in the vast majority of patients like that.
And I think with the fast evolving updates that we're having with AI, this is going to be a reality in the next this is what two I'm to saying. 3 years, something
this
like
is
that.
This is what I'm saying to you. I mean, I'll be stunned. If we did this session again in probably 5 years' time, I'll be stunned if we're doing a huge amount of breath hold work.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, that's fascinating, the way things are evolving. I know a few scanners already can detect if the patient is in distress or not.
Mm.
So I think we're going quite fast in that direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. And about this, actually, I was very interested when I saw that one of your massive research along with AI, that which we already touched and we'll discuss a little bit in just a few moments, is also about T1 and T2 maps, which is something I believe, as a radiographer, I can tell. Sometimes I notice, I include myself in this category, sometimes we just perform, sometimes we don't even know why, what might be actually the advantage, the rationale behind acquiring the T2 or T1 map on this patient. We might have the glitch of it, say, yeah, we do it for this reason, but most of the time we just say, yeah, we need to acquire T1 map. So can you explain to the audience a little bit more how it works?
Yeah, so if you want to take a slightly humorous starting point with this, putting color on stuff, of course, is quite novel.
Of course.
In MRI, where we're used to, black and white grayscale imaging. So straight away, actually, it appeals straight to your eye to see the color. Although, of course, you're looking, thinking potentially, well, what does it all actually mean? What it's really trying to do is give you numbers. It's about quantification. So rather than, say, where you might have used Siemens speaker turbo spin echo sequence for T1 or used STIR imaging, which is, in effect, grayscale. You can't tell from a T1 turbo spin echo image what's the T1 of the bit of tissue you're studying, whatever it might be, a bit of muscle in the leg, whatever it might be you're looking at, heart muscle. Mapping is basically trying to allow you to put numbers on it. So you can draw a region of interest. When you do mapping, so you get this beautiful color picture, you draw a region of interest in the myocardium and say the T1 in this area is 1050. So you've got a number. Now, then the question, well, what does that number mean?
That's what I was going to ask. So what does the number mean? Because they vary a lot.
So one of the challenges then with this is around normal ranges, which are variable depending upon which manufacturer you use, which sequence you use. And this has been the challenge in the field.
Yes.
Much more, and one of the nice things around T2 Star, which looks at cardiac iron, is it's just uniform across scanners, sequences. It works really well because of that. T1 mapping, you've got to have a bit of your own data around scans. What I would say around Siemens T1 mapping sequences, in the end, there was lots of choice, and they got off the fence eventually to use one that is what you will see on your own Siemens scanner. So I think you've got...
We have a 1.5 Siemens and a 3 Tesla Geneva.
Yeah, so they got off the fence and they've basically picked it. So you don't get a lot of choice now. It looks like you've got a choice of four, but they're this sort of same sequence tweak slightly. across different Siemens scanners, the normal ranges are fairly uniform, because I've done this across a whole number now. You don't see huge variation. But if you make it 3T, completely different, clearly. So you need normal ranges. So, of course, then you get a number from the patient that you can compare to your normal range. Things that might increase T1 are things like scar, inflammation. So this is why it's of interest in the myocarditis field. So inflammation in the heart muscle will increase your T1. Infiltration with various things like amyloid protein. So these things will all increase your T1 value. And T2 is very sensitive for lots of disease. If you're increasing T1, as I said, could be scar, could be, you know, T2 is much more specific to inflammatory conditions. So T2 mapping is nice for the acute stuff and myocarditis particularly. So the patient who's acutely unwell in hospital, T2 mapping is very useful. Patients with autoimmune diseases where they might get myocarditis, that sort of thing, very, very useful.
Would you acquire the full stack normally for myocarditis?
Well, so now...
Because it can be very time-consuming for us.
million-dollar question.
Well, this then becomes... So, of course, and this is... I mean, this is a broad question around all MRI. There's so much you can do. I mean, there's lots of different... I mean, I know nothing about how you scan a knee, but there's no doubt lots of different ways to do it. Absolutely. It depends who the reporter is. They'll say, I like this, 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 and this. And you'll think, well, the other person likes it done that way. You could do it all on every patient, but you wouldn't get many scans done. So you've got to take a view of where do I draw the line with this, because I need to have a working relationship with my radiographers, and if they keep going home late from work every day, but that is the reality. And if you're doing a full cardiac dedicated list where you're doing quite a lot of cases, so some of it for me depends on what you are looking for. Mm-hmm. There are some patients where it is completely unhelpful to do a lot of mapping, because what you think you're looking at is a very diffuse disease process, and therefore, you know, doing 8 cuts through the left ventricle is like, well, you should see it on one, because the process you're looking for. So, for example, amyloidosis is a good example of this. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it's a very diffuse disease, and although I have a bit of focal stuff, I mean, doing 8 slices through the ventricle might be a vague interest in the academic world, but in clinical, it's well overkill. My own practice typically is, my default position is to do 5 images. So I do a 4th chamber, 3 chamber and 2 chamber long axis and a basal and mid short axis. That's my default position with it. The reason for that is the same as late GAD. If you see an abnormality in both long axis and short axis, it's probably real.
There you go.
So it's about trying to build in a degree of redundancy, it's trying to build in a degree of reproducibility and a degree of, particularly for subtle stuff, if you only see it in one view and not the other, it might still be real because you don't know which one's right, but you're going to be a little bit more sitting on the fence around it. If you see it in 2 views, and of course for inflammatory conditions, most often what you'll see is the T1 and T2 will be elevated. And so in effect, you've got 4 chances with it. So you've got long axis, short axis, T1 and T2. If they're all abnormal, the report is going to be very bold.
Yeah.
You know, this is clearly
your life,
no debate. I could show this to 100 cardiologists. Yeah. They're all going to tell you the same thing. If one of those 4 images is abnormal, then you've got to be a little bit more careful. And you're thinking, well, okay, am I sure about this? And you may have to write a report that's a bit more of a fence set. So that's how I like to do it, rather than just doing lots of short axes.
That is very clear. Absolutely.
The long axis I find helpful.
Absolutely
with it.
Clear.
So it's just about the T1 and T2 they were just talking about. My question is, do you believe there's some bias, manufactured bias, when you do research, if you're using different manufacturers for do that research? Let's say you're doing research on a cardiac pathology with the Siemens scanner, and you use T1 and T2 mapping there, and you say the range of values might change according to the manufacturer that you're using.
Very much.
And then you sit down on a GE scanner, you do the same cohort of patients looking for the same kind of pathology. Is there some manufacturer bias there that you have to actually state on the paper, or you don't mention that?
One of the challenges would be if you want to do a large multi-center trial, if you did it with multiple different magnets with multiple different sequences, actually trying to do something with the data will then, of course, be more complicated. So we're desperate when we do stuff to try and not do this. Because you think, so for example, let's say you've got amyloidosis, and on the Siemens scanner, your T1 is 1150, but there's a completely different normal range on GE, and the normal range goes up to 800, and on a, therefore it's not. If you plonk all those numbers in together and do an average, it becomes almost meaningless. So the statistics around it become very difficult. I mean, all I would say to you, I think probably what you get, the key thing is having normal ranges. You have to have different normal ranges for the for these groups. The manufacturers will probably make some argument that some sequences are better than others. That probably is true to some extent. As always in MRI, there's, you know, swings and roundabouts. I mean, even amongst Siemens, there was lots of debate about which sequence should be used as the main one in the end. You know, at the end of the day, most of them have gone down the same path now. I actually don't know what GE ended up doing, because I don't work with a GE scanner, but I think that they went, in the end, I think they went down the same path with the same sort of sequence technology.
Very interesting. Extremely interesting. And also before, you mentioned that you have quite a lot of expectations about the future of cardiac MRI, especially combined with artificial intelligence.
Yep.
So, well, they always said that the future might be now. So what do you think is the current, let's call it, status of art of like artificial intelligence in cardiac MRI? What are the benefits, implications, and also challenges?
Well, it may put me out of a job. I mean, I think, so broadly speaking, there's two sides to this, isn't there? There's one, what it might do to the person writing the report, and the other is what it might do for the person doing the scan. What I would like to see, and there's loads of PhD and interest in this from the radiographer's perspective, is what you want in the background. Having a cardiologist supervise isn't easy for a whole number of reasons, right? So when we first met, it was odd for you having a clinician in the room, right?
Yeah.
So this is what happens. You know, clinician here is a bit of an odd feeling.
So that pressure
this,
as well.
This, isn't yes, it? My this is my domain. I don't normally have a radiologist in here when I'm doing an E type thing. You know, I would tell the radiologist what to do, and this is a slightly odd setup. It's also for us. I mean, I love it, but for most cardiologists, they don't love being part of it.
Yes.
Where the benefit comes is if there's a problem along the way. It's a bit like what you were talking about with the ECG. But sometimes you go into a scan thinking you're going to find something, and actually what you end up seeing is completely left field, and you therefore want to change things. And that may be difficult for the radiographer. If the radiographer is quite senior and seen lots, they'll work it out. If it's someone quite junior, much more difficult. So what I suspect you may find with the AI is it starts giving you an idea. So for example, if you have on the scanner, it telling you the right heart's a bit big. Now, that might be hard to spot at the time of the scan, but of course, if you knew that, you might run a whole load of things thinking, well, why is it quite big? I'm going to do some flow imaging with this or that, whatever.
There you go, yeah.
The AI, I think, is going to help with this. It may also, I mean, you already see it on Siemens, help your planning.
Yep.
Some of the planning stuff, that will get better.
You have the dot system.
That's what I'm saying. So those things will all continue to improve. Because if you can teach the three of us to do it, you can teach a computer to do it.
Of course.
Right? We have mentioned this. Apologies, but we have mentioned this. There is a new vendor, which is called United
Imaging.
Yeah, they're doing basically the auto line, almost kind of like.
It does it all by itself.
Yeah,
right?
That does everything by itself, almost. So yeah, so we're definitely reaching that.
So from the radiographer's perspective, this is going to change a lot with this. From the reporter's perspective, there are many steps in the reporting process that are bloody arduous, and it will help you straight away with that. I mean, going forward in the future, of course, if you're reporting in a particular hospital, it might even help you looking at patient notes. There's just a whole number of steps that take quite a lot of time. When I was doing my research, a lot of it was drawing circles to try and get left ventricular sizes. Yes. And you laugh, but, you know, I ended up with repetitive strain injury.
Really? Just
because you end up, but, I mean.
Because you're doing each one of them manually, and you have to do more, three or four in the same picture sometimes on the same scan.
When you start putting your mind, thinking about your list of 10, you know, sort of thing, it's not a minor thing. Now, of course, the technology is already much better than that. I often laugh with the fellows saying, you know, this used to be much more complicated. But it will continue to improve. I still draw too many circles. There should be no need for me to do that. Mm-hmm. So I still draw too many circles with this. I think in the end, it's also going to help alert you to pathology. So some of the challenges cardiologists reporting is the extra cardiac anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
So we maybe in 1-2% of scans find bad things, you know, lung cancers, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, you know, our training for this sort of thing is much less than a radiologist's training. So I think it will help you with that sort of thing as well. It's coming. I mean, it's all coming.
I think it's here already.
Yes,
I think
what I'm saying.
It's here already. It's a matter of adapting to it as quick as possible. Yeah, I think AI is replacing most the cognitive skills.
Yeah.
Not as much as the motor skills, because nobody's going to position the patient for us.
Yeah.
But the reporting side of it, or the anatomy planning, that's the easiest part AI will take over for sure.
That's the lower hanging fruit.
One of the concerns is liability. What do you think about? Someone say, are we going to blame a computer for like potential wrong diagnosis that someone else has provided?
I mean, and you see, I mean, in the UK at the moment, you see there's this big scandal over the post office where all these terrible things happen because some computer software got something wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and it Absolutely. Ruined people's lives. So, yeah, this that, is
that's
a big
exactly
problem.
What Julian is mentioning, that we want to avoid that kind of situation. But
so you can sort of envisage that the role of the reporter is going to be, there will still be a role for the reporter for the foreseeable future, looking over all of this. But one of the challenges, I think, because a lot of the reports I do, some of them I do the whole thing myself, some of them, one of my juniors has done a pre-report. Even though you know that they're not at consultant level, they straight away still biases you a little bit in how you're thinking, and the AI report's going to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and often that will be because it's right. But occasionally if it's got it wrong, you may go into it in the wrong mindset when the words are already on a page in front of you, rather than if you were just doing it from the outset.
At the end of the day, if something is wrong on that report, are you answer for it, or is it the manufacturer of the AI system that provided that report?
This will be the challenge.
I think that's the main challenge, right? That's
why
you were asking. I think that's the main problem.
I suspect for the long foreseeable future, responsibility is going to fall on the clinician.
Yeah.
Which isn't fair.
Well,
kind of, I would say. Because if you're using that tool to aid you do a better job, and then because of the tool, and you know it's because of the tool, let's put it that way, and there was an error there, you miss it, or you miss something because that tool was biased in the data that it learned from.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's going to fall on you, and it's kind of an unfair situation, but it's something that we have to adapt in as quick as possible, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And it probably, as I say, in the short term, it won't be I can see problems with this in 10 years' time, where you become potentially heavily reliant on it. At the moment, someone like me isn't used to that, therefore probably would be much more interested. I can imagine in 10 years' time, where everyone says, oh, it's great, this software never gets it wrong, you know. But you then become more blasé. At that point, you've become more trusting of it. At this stage, we'll all be going into it thinking, I'm sure it's very good, but I'd like to have a look myself before trust. So I suspect down the line that will be an issue. And that's going to have to be debated amongst the medical profession.
Absolutely.
Because it's not just going to be radiology where this is an issue. It's going to be a whole number of things outside too where there'll be similar problems.
Perfect. I think we would have a lot to talk maybe in another session.
Right? Yeah,
we're reaching almost the time.
We
have one more question. I think is our final questions that
Please,
we do for all our guests. And we want to understand, why MRI for you?
I mean, I think I said to you at the beginning, I love imaging the heart, and I loved about ultrasound originally, and it's the same for me with MRI, is you get all this information, and the biggest risk to the patient is getting to the hospital. Yeah, they're more likely to be involved in a road traffic accident, being blunt, getting to you, than having a problem with most of what you're going to do to them. So getting all this information in an extremely safe manner. What I love about MRI over ultrasound is that ultrasound is, some patients have beautiful ultrasound images. Same with ultrasound in your tummy. Some people, MRI, it's unusual to get a terrible set of images. If you do a list of 10, 9 of them will be a good set. So you're just seeing beautiful images of what is very often interesting things, because we don't do a huge amount of normal scans. So you're seeing a lot of interesting cardiology, and that then makes you feel like you're making a difference to the patient, who in the end is the person who is going to benefit from this. So.
Absolutely. Julian, do you want to add anything else?
No, actually, I wanted to talk a little bit more AI and cardiac another session.
I think we will definitely need another session.
I would like to come back. I'd like to
Absolutely.
Come back.
We would like to ask you one more thing.
Yeah.
We always give this to our guests to
give
a small signature and small comment to us. So if you don't mind.
I'm delighted.
No problem.
And we really
appreciate
the fact that you were here with us today.
Absolutely.
So it's a pleasure. I mean, for me, chance to educate and chat about MRI, always happy.
Wonderful.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dan. You're very kind. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.